Hey everyone, hope you're all enjoying this summer weather. Some of you will know that if you ever travel to Israel, one of the highlights of the trip is the boat journey on the Sea of Galilee. It's a standard part of most of the pilgrimages. And a few years back, I took all the staff team, and I was adamant that they were going to have this experience. And we were traveling in two cars. And unfortunately, because we were only a small group, we have to join another group. And I've always enjoyed this. This is sometimes quite an ecumenical kind of experience because you join different traditions. One year, I managed to jump ship with a bunch of Filipino nuns. And they let me get on their boat, and we went out in the Sea of Galilee, and it was all very circumspect and very devout, and we did some liturgy, and it was wonderful and quiet. And then always on the way back, the boat drivers want to sell their CDs, so they usually do like a karaoke. It kind of takes away from the experience sometimes a little bit, but these Filipino nuns loved it. They were up dancing, they were getting us dancing. I was like videoing this and thinking, nobody's going to believe this. Anyway, on this occasion, I'd managed to book a trip with a group of Brazilians. Unfortunately, one of our drivers had locked the keys for the car into the car. And so there was a mad dash to try and get everybody onto the boat, and I had to drive. And I was adamant that this driver had to have the experience of getting on this boat with these Brazilians, and so I forced him into the car, rushed him over, and got him on the boat just as it took off. Anyway, it was 50 Brazilian Pentecostals going out in the Sea of Galilee. And let's just say, it was a wild, apparently the guy preached for ages, screaming, shouting out. And my friend that I forced onto the boat, he got off and he said, that was the worst experience of my entire life. I kind of felt, oh, okay, maybe going out in the Sea of Galilee isn't such a critical part of the pilgrimage. Here we have somebody else having an experience, or a group of people having an experience in the Sea of Galilee, one that maybe wasn't so particularly Pentecostal, but one that generated a greater understanding of who Jesus is. The Sea of Galilee is found right in towards the north of Israel. It's a large lake. It's sometimes called Lake Gennesaret, which means harp in Hebrew. It's that because it's a sort of harp shape. And it's actually one of the most serene and loveliest places that you can go and visit in Israel. It's quite beautiful. And a few years ago, in 1986, there's a constant issue with water in the region. Water is more precious, actually, than oil in the region now, especially nowadays. And you've heard of the Golan Heights that were taken from Russia in 1967, and the Golan Heights overlooks the Sea of Galilee, and is highly contested because it allows control of the Sea of Galilee, which is the principal water source in the region. And a few years ago, because everybody keeps taking water out of the Sea of Galilee, the levels had reduced significantly within the sea. And it uncovered in the mud a fishing boat from the time of Jesus. And it was discovered by two fishermen, and the archaeologists came along, and there was a lot of effort and ingenuity went into salvaging and redeeming this boat. And they managed to extract it. They encased it in this foam-like substance. And then they took it and dried it out. And similar to what happened with the Mary Rose, actually, down in Portsmouth. And now you can actually go and see this boat. And it's a wonderful little visual aid in terms of the sort of boats that they had at that time and what they looked like. And if you go to the next picture, you might not be able to see this too clearly. But basically, there were two shelves at either end of the boat. There was a large platform right at the front of the boat, which was used for fishing. They would use nets, they would throw them over the side, and then haul them back in and see what they've caught in terms of the fish. So in order to do that, you need a platform. And so they had this large platform where obviously the fishermen would all stand and they'd throw over their nets and they would catch. And then at the stern of the boat, at the back of the boat, there's a smaller platform, a little V. And in this story, we're told that Jesus, after a busy time in terms of ministry, was lying at the back of this boat in that little area, probably on that platform, sleeping as they were sailing out onto the boat. And suddenly, this incredible storm got up. And one of the things that's distinctive in terms of the Sea of Galilee, and I've now been to Israel so many times, I think I have seen it just about in all of its incarnations in terms of weather. The most shocking one was when I went one May a couple of years back with a group of folks from the church, and I told them, because May is a really dry month, and we were starting off staying in Jericho, which is the desert, where it rains like once every 2 years. And I told them, you won't need jackets, it's May. Never rains in May. And Jericho took a year and a half's rainfall in 1.5 hours where we were staying there. The roads got washed out. And it didn't happen just once. It happened on 2 consecutive days. And it was created by a sort of typhoon effect, like a pressure cooker effect, that came in over the country and generated all this rain and the storm in the middle of May. Well, a similar thing happens on a regular basis in the Sea of Galilee, because there are a series of valleys that funnel down into the sea. It generates storm clouds that can very rapidly appear, just funneling down these valleys. And then suddenly, if you've got this high pressure over it, it will generate a storm on the lake, which is basically generated in terms of wind. And you'll see again in the story, it talks about a wind, not so much a storm, but a windstorm. And it was suddenly this wind was being generated and created in this situation. And so we see Jesus asleep in the boat and suddenly this dramatic storm coming along. Mark wants to tell this story so that we understand something in terms of the nature of who Jesus is. There's a lot of debate about Mark. Mark's the first gospel, and certainly in recent academic scholarship, a lot of writings about Mark. In fact, everybody's got to write about Mark. It's like in the old days, you used to have to write about Roman at some point. Nowadays, you have to write about Mark at some point. And I basically believe that Mark's really divided into two sections. And it's written to do two things. The first half of it is written actually to show that Jesus is God. A lot of scholars don't like that idea because they don't like the idea that the notion that Jesus was God happened really early on and that Mark, the first of the Gospels, would reflect this idea. But I think it's very much there if you read these stories very carefully. You'll see particularly in Mark 2, one of the stories that I was chatting to someone recently about, which was the statement where Jesus says, man was not made for the Sabbath, but Sabbath for man. And a lot of people read that, and in fact, this guy was presenting the talk, and he was saying, well, basically what this is saying is that the Sabbath was a day of rest for humanity and for us and things. But I was showing him, or I was trying to show him, don't know if I convinced him, but I said, if you read that carefully in context, you'll see that each one of them, each one of the stories, there's 3 of them actually, one about forgiving sins, one about the bridegroom having arrived, and then one about the Sabbath. Each one of them are actually making a claim in terms of Jesus. Jesus has the authority to forgive sins. Jesus is the bridegroom, the one that creation is waiting for. And Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. The man that Sabbath was made for is not humanity, but Jesus. What Jesus was saying was, he was saying the Sabbath was made for me. And if you look at those 3 claims, they are all direct claims to divinity. He's basically saying, I'm God. He's saying, I was there when everything was created. And in fact, this was created for me. Now, just imagine that claim. And so Mark is, in the first half, trying to show that Jesus is God. But it was to be a secret. And you'll notice even in this story, and as you read on, Jesus keeps telling people, don't tell folks, don't tell folks. But God has become incarnate and he's walking amongst us, but it's hidden in some sense. And so that's what the first half of Mark is about. And then the second half of Mark, and it turns about Mark 9, verse 31, I think it is, where Jesus starts to talk about his death, is actually dealing with the fact that this God was crucified and that this God entered into our suffering. See, for an ancient audience, the notion that God came and dwelt, not for a Jewish audience, but certainly for a Gentile audience, they could deal with that. The notion that the divine had somehow entered the human world and engaged our world, they could deal with that. But the notion that this God would not come and conquer the earth, that this God would not demonstrate his glory, that this God would humble himself and suffer and die, this notion was incredible. In fact, many of the ancient writers would say that the evidence that Jesus was not God is found in his crucifixion. The fact that Jesus was crucified demonstrates incontrovertibly that Jesus is not God. And what Mark is trying to do is he's trying to show us that Jesus was God, and yet this God enters into our suffering. And in a very similar way, as he tells this story, he's trying to tell and communicate this idea of this miracle-working God. The obvious connection to suggest as we see the calming of the storm is that it's affirming Jesus is Lord, and particularly Lord of creation. He is the one who is over all of creation. Again, tying it back to the stories that we saw earlier, where Jesus is seen to be the Lord of the Sabbath. This idea that somehow Jesus reigns and is over the whole of the created order. And this majestic vision, you'll find that vision actually in Revelation. It's the basis of worship in heaven. This vision of Jesus as the Lord of creation. And this idea, and it's very tempting to actually take this story and talk about Jesus, who is Lord of creation and who commands the waves and the sea and the wind and who is Lord of all. But actually, I don't think that's what Mark was trying to demonstrate in this story. I think he had earlier demonstrated that Jesus was God. Now he wanted to show that Jesus is Lord, but he is Lord over the destroyer. You see, there are two stories that are held here side by side. This one in relation to creation and the storm, and then another one in terms of a demoniac who lived amongst in a graveyard, who was possessed by, it says, 1,000 demons. His name was Legion. And it talks about how Jesus confronted him, delivered him of these demons that were sent into pigs, and then he was found to be in his right mind. See, these two stories are told side by side. And interestingly, the language that is used in this story, when Jesus stands up and he says, "Peace, be still," is the same language that is used in Mark chapter 1, verse 25, when Jesus casts out the demon, the first demon out of the man who appears in the synagogue. He says, "Shut up, but it's peace, be still." That's actually the Greek word that is being used there. And so we have the same dynamic happening here. We see Jesus as Lord taking authority over that which would destroy. Talked before about how in the New Testament, when it talks about evil spirits, that word evil is not so much a moral concept. It's not so much a concept of right and wrong. The idea of evil, both in the Old and New Testament, is used in the sense of that which destroys. So evil is that which breaks apart, that which robs, that which takes from you. And good is actually that which is wholesome, that which restores, that which makes whole. The word shalom, peace, very much conjures this idea. And so evil is the opposite of peace, wholeness, completeness. Evil is actually where you're in a state which is broken apart, which is damaged. And so when it talks about people having works of evil spirits in their lives, what it's saying is the work of the destroyer. Because, again, the New Testament tells us that's how Satan operates. He robs and he steals and he kills. And so the work of the destroyer, the deceiver, the one who robs from us what God intends for us, is at operation in this person's life in some way. And so Jesus comes into these scenarios and he breaks people free from these things so that they're found to be whole again, so that they discover peace and are found in their right minds. And this is the same scenario, but it's doing it not on an individual level. It's talking about the whole of creation. That here Jesus as Lord comes and he confronts the brokenness, the trauma, the work of the destroyer within creation. And he confronts this. Oscar Wilde, when I was a lot younger, I used to read a lot of Oscar Wilde. And Oscar Wilde wrote a brilliant essay once about creation. And he said, you know, everybody goes on about how wonderful creation is and everything. And he said, but reality is we spend most of our lives protecting ourselves from it. And we don't actually live with it. We actually try and protect ourselves from it and run from it and live in houses and move away from it because maybe it's not quite so idyllic. And here we see Jesus as Lord taking authority over the work of the destroyer in creation. And Mark is trying to communicate to us that Jesus is not only Lord in the sense that he is God, but he is also Lord in terms of his activity, in terms of his activity countering the work of the destroyer and the one who robs. And it's interesting that in the midst of the situation where the disciples are finding themselves subject to this storm and to this destructive storm, that their first question, there's kind of two questions that go on in the story. The disciples ask a question of Jesus, and Jesus asks a couple of questions of the disciples. And the disciples come to Jesus and they say, don't you care we are perishing? Don't you care we are perishing? It's an interesting question, and often a quick question that people ask when they experience destructive things in their lives. See, destruction can be brought into our lives in different ways. It can be brought into our lives by the choices that we make. And sometimes we make destructive and bad choices, evil choices that cause brokenness. But sometimes destruction can be thrust upon us. Sometimes brokenness can just happen to us. I often meet people whose marriages maybe have broken apart, and that's, I'm sure most of us know individuals. And oftentimes you'll talk to individuals and it wasn't necessarily anything that they necessarily deliberately went out to do. But things got broken. And sometimes with terrible, harrowing effect and impact on their lives. And it wasn't that they had made bad choices. It was just that the circumstances and maybe other people's bad choices actually impacted them in a highly detrimental way, and suddenly they had this experience of brokenness. By the way, I was recently listening to a talk on divorce, and it was a really telling talk. It was by a Christian, a very recognized Christian leader in Scotland, and his parents had divorced. And he said, you know, his mother's ordeal with divorce. And they underwent that experience. But what was even harder for her was the reaction of the church. And that actually the church was more of a detrimental experience for her as she underwent that. Even though she was essentially the victim in the scenario. I know everybody says there are two parties, but nonetheless, she was essentially the one that was being wronged in the divorce. And yet the church's reaction. You know, it's interesting how we react in terms of the work of the destroyer. I continue to hammer on this theme that we struggle, and it's becoming a bigger struggle as well as our culture changes. But our churches struggle when people don't fit the Wimpy House or the Calla House, the 2.2 kids, and the Ford Mondeo car, and they come along and everything's fine. We struggle. We don't quite know what to do. And we've conflated our middle-class values so much with our faith that sometimes it's hard to work it out. And sometimes when the work of the destroyer occurs in a person's life, you know, it's hard to know. And for the person who's going through it, maybe you've been going through things and experiencing things. You know, the question that often is on people's lips is, don't you care? We are perishing. Don't you care about what's happening? You know, I've lived a relatively easy life, relatively pain-free. But I've known occasions and times when I've turned around to God and say, you know, don't you care, God? Don't you care? You know, and for those who have gone through more harrowing and traumatic things, you know that. Don't you care we are perishing? The Psalms are very honest in the emotions that they sing. I love the Psalms, and in fact, it's a shame we don't still sing the Psalms, because in a way, their lyrics are much more real than a lot of the things that we sing today, because it's all triumphalistic and God's great, and that's all true. But actually, also, life is hard. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of unfairness. There's a lot of injustice. And sometimes we just don't feel like worshiping God. And I most times, if you read a psalm, it will start off saying, God, I'm fed up with you. You know, you just don't seem to be caring about me. Everything's gone wrong for me. Like, and usually what happens by the end of the psalm, the guy comes around and he says, oh, but you're the God of creation and I love you and your covenant towards me is great. But one of my favorite psalms is Psalm 44, because it never gets there. And if you read Psalm 44, and it's pertinent to this story, the psalmist actually accuses God of being asleep. And at the end of it, he says, why don't you wake up? Wake up, God. Do something. That's how it finishes. Oh, okay. And here we have this experience with the disciples. They're crying out and saying, God, why don't you wake up? Why don't you do something? Why don't you operate in terms of our situation? This expression of frustration. And maybe this morning you're a little bit like this. Jesus asked two questions of the disciples. First of all, he says, why are you afraid? That's an interesting question. Why are you afraid? I think he recognizes that fear is an essential human emotion. And actually, fear is often at the behind many of the experiences that we undergo. You know, if your marriage falls apart, there's a fear. What will people think? What will people say? You know, what will happen to me? You know, what about my financial security? What about in the church? You know, there's a fear thing. You know, we're scared. We're afraid. We're afraid when things go wrong in our businesses, and suddenly, I know people who have basically zero money in their bank accounts, and they're still going out and driving cars that, you know, in my wildest dreams, I couldn't afford. And you're going, what are you doing? But, you know, it's that fear. There was actually a guy, I lived in a very wealthy middle-class area in the southeast of England, and there was a guy who lost his job in the city of London as a banker, and these guys were on astronomical amounts. It was in the 80s and early 90s, and for 6 months, he went into the library, the British Library, every single day, and it wasn't discovered by his family that he was unemployed until one of his relatives saw him in the British Library sitting there and said, what are you doing? 6 months. Why was he afraid? Because he didn't want to be seen to be failing. He didn't want to accept it. And for many of us, this question of why are we afraid? Because Jesus then turns around and says, have you no faith? Faith in the New Testament is this ability to see beyond the physical. Faith allows us to look at Jesus of Nazareth and see not only a man, but see God incarnate. That's what faith allows us to do. Faith allows us to see beyond the merely physical things and circumstances that surround us. Faith allows us to look at our situation and our circumstances and see that God is bigger than that situation. And that God is bigger than the storm. God is bigger than the work of the destroyer. God is bigger than anything that we are ultimately going through. And it counters the fear. Because we understand that our futures are in the Lord's hands. He's the one who is the Lord of our future. He's the one who safeguards us and protects us. And he's the one who brings wholeness and peace in the midst of brokenness and the consequences of the work of the destroyer. This morning, I just want us to invite us to think on this story. And maybe in your life, you're feeling at the moment that you're experiencing the work of the destroyer. Maybe it was many years ago, maybe it's right now, but you're feeling that you've been robbed of things, that you're under attack in relation to things. You have things in your life that you're afraid that if people saw them or they knew about them, that they would think less of you. And Jesus wants you to know this morning that he is Lord and that he holds your future. And that if you trust in him and have faith, you will see the storm calm and know his peace, his wholeness. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I thank you for your words. And I just pray that as we're here this morning, that we'll just hear you speak into our lives. Why are you afraid? Why are you afraid to be known for who you are? Why are you afraid to admit your need? Why are you afraid to receive my healing? Lord, help us in our unbelief. Help us to have faith and see that you are Lord, that you are the one who transcends our circumstances, who transcends the storms of our lives, that you're the one who, although it seems at times you may be asleep, yet you're awake and at work in our lives. Lord, help us know this. Amen.